You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you send and receive calls and texts from your new business phone number. That way, you can run your business from anywhere and respond to clients quickly with Grasshopper's mobile apps. Grasshopper. Sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. And now, enjoy the podcast.
If providing a platform for white supremacists makes me a brilliant tactician, I am glad to have lost. And when give me a minute, David. When I am more proud of Hillary Clinton's all right speech than any other moment on the campaign, because she had the courage to stand up. I would rather lose than win the way you guys did.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a clip from a discussion between the Hillary Clinton campaign communications director, Jennifer Palmieri, and her counterpart on the Trump campaign, Kellyanne Conway, at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government's 2016 election postmortem. After enduring the gloating and smug taunts of the Trump campaign staff, Palmieri launches into an impassioned stream of consciousness, calling out the Trump campaign for courting white nationalists and giving voice to Americans' darkest instincts. For Jennifer Palmieri, it was one of the most heart-wrenching moments surrounding an election in which emotions already ran high and nerves were frayed. But she says she's been inspired by the women's movement that swept the country in response to Donald Trump, and now she's decided to turn the results of the 2016 election into something empowering for future female leaders and independent thinkers everywhere in a new book titled Dear Madam President, an open letter to the women who will run the world. And today, Jennifer Palmieri joins me on the show to share her insider's perspective on the campaign and give some insight into the candidate who she says was reluctant to run for president this time around. As a matter of fact, she says Hillary Clinton didn't believe she had a compelling personal narrative and was all too aware of the slings and arrows that would come her way. Palmieri discusses the complexities of running the first female candidate for president, what was really behind so many Americans' complaints that they, quote, just didn't like Hillary, and why the next woman who runs for president needs to write her own playbook, not emulate her male predecessors. She also shares some wisdom from another famous female mentor of hers, the late Elizabeth Edwards. She re-examines the role of former FBI Director James Comey in the 2016 election and explains why Hillary Clinton's email problem was about way more than just emails. Plus, Jennifer Palmieri responds to all those armchair strategists who asked, where was that Hillary after her concession speech? She suggests that candidates for office should cry more and nod less, and she casts the 2016 election as a Batman movie. Coming up in just a moment. Jennifer Palmieri was director of communications for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign, Prior to that, she worked in the Clinton White House, was the National Press Secretary for the 2004 John Edwards presidential campaign and for the Democratic National Committee, and served as White House Communications Director for President Barack Obama. She's currently president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and she's written a new book titled Dear Madam President, An Open Letter to the Women Who Will Run the World. Jennifer Palmieri, welcome to the podcast.
I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So it's Palmieri, it's not Palmieri?
It is. My family pronounces it Palmieri.
Okay.
Although the Italian way would be Palmieri.
Okay.
Mieri. It's kind of a mouthful.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about me, but I always have this terrible habit of arguing with people about the pronunciation of their Italian last name. I did that to Steve Buscemi just the other day as well, which apparently is supposed to be pronounced Buscemi.
Yeah, because it's different than in English. C. One C in Italian is a hard C, and that is not what we expect to find.
Well, when I first heard the title of your new book, Dear Madam President, I assumed you were addressing Hillary Clinton, maybe in some alternative reality where we don't have a narcissist in the White House and don't have to worry about our geopolitical enemy maybe calling the shots here in America. Would that were the case, but
that sounds appealing.
It's not actually written to Hillary Clinton. Yeah. So who is your audience for this book?
My audience actually, I very consciously wanted to write something that was forward-looking and optimistic, that was based on lessons that I learned in 2016, and also just as a woman who's been working in politics for a long time. But my audience was young women, girls in high school, young women in college, young women entering the workforce, and I called it Dear Madam President. You know, my orientation is politics. That, to me, that's the ultimate goal someone can read, just be president of the United States. But I wanted whoever was reading the book to open it as a letter to them with the assumption that they have achieved whatever their greatest dream is. And I found that, after Hillary lost, it was devastating days. And as it was for a lot of people in the country. But an interesting thing happened shortly after the election, which is, I think, women decided, rather than to be devastated, that they were going to take this as a moment to feel empowered and lead in a different way. And that book is about imagining what that might be like for you.
Yeah, and this does seem to be a seminal moment for women with the Women's March and the Time's Up movement.
Yeah.
Do you think Hillary deserves some of the credit for that?
I don't know that she needs credit. I don't think that, she doesn't. I don't think it's not what she's in it for. I think that.
But do you think that that was part of the
movement? I think it's a reaction. I do think it's a reaction to Trump, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that.
Right.
So what it felt like to me was that, Hillary, very similar to other women in her generation, baby boomer generation.
Yeah.
She had to prove that she could do the job just the same as anyone who had the job before her, which is any man that had the job before her. And I think that, that was true across the board for women in different professions of her generation. And we did that, and we ran her to show that she had the qualities you look for in a male president. But that sort of reduces her to this like female facsimile for the qualities like for a male president. That was a fundamental flaw in the design.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't imagine any other way, because that's the only model that's all we have. And I think after she lost, women had to decide, okay, either the man Donald Trump was meant to win in America, or the rules that we have been playing by are outdated. We haven't plateaued. They have. Those rules are no longer service. And so we are going to go make our own rules and create our own game. And what I want women to take away from this is that when you do hold yourself back, and I talk about this in the book, about even, when I was a White House communications director, even with all of the authority that title gave me, still being intimidated by speaking up in the Oval Office and talking to the President of the United States, is that if you don't speak up you're robbing not just yourself, but everyone of your perspective.
Yeah.
And that, you know, if you're the person in the meeting who hasn't spoken, or if you're, if there's five people and four of them are men and you're the only woman, your perspective matters more, not less, because you have a different insight. And
that's
really what I saw with both President Obama and when I worked for President Clinton. They were the most interested to hear from the people in the room who didn't look like everybody else.
Really?
Right? Yeah. So not if you think about
that's
it, it's
smart.
Not that surprising, but it is right. But it's the person who didn't go to the same colleges, who particularly women of color or men of color, that they would have something that would that the president, either Obama or Clinton, would draw the most insight from. And that is, you know, there's things that we're told as women are professional and not professional to do. And, you know, I look at that now and I think, when you tell me something I do in the workplace isn't professional, it's because you think that's not what men normally do, right?
Yeah,
so
it's crying.
Like crying. I have
say,
a whole chapter.
Don't
be afraid to cry. I don't sob at work, but I am easily moved to tears because I say something that's important to me and it might move me to tears, or I hear something that's moving. And I don't think that women should need to mute all of our emotions and passions. I don't think anyone looks at America today and says, we have all the tools we need to make it great.
But isn't that a risky choice for any candidate, not just a woman?
To cry?
Yeah.
I don't think that you should do, I mean, I would step back and say the book overall is, you know, it's like my experiences and what I have embraced in my life that I feel makes me stronger, more effective. And I want to provoke people to read it and see what it means for you. But crying, I don't sob at work, but I don't think that, you know, sometimes women need to cry to let off steam. Sometimes men do it because they're angry, they're frustrated. But moreover, what troubles me is when people say, well, I was going to say something, but I couldn't get through it without crying, so I didn't. Yeah. And you think, wow, if it was something that moved you to tears, it was probably really important to you.
Yeah.
And it'd be great for everybody to hear that.
Yeah.
So the other thing I want women to keep in mind is, you know, the workplace, through no one's fault, we spent centuries building it and making it a comfortable place for men to succeed in. And, you know, like any good guest, women, you know, come in and they look at the custom. We try to observe the local customs and figure out how things go and how we're meant to behave to, you know, in a respectful way. And did that for a long time. And now, you know, now I think that if you encounter that, then you should think about how you change it so it's a good supportive place for you to work in. And, you know, the same with looking for your story to be represented in the press. Sometimes that doesn't happen, too. So what I see instead is women going out and starting their own podcasts, women going out, starting their own platforms, their own. You know, that's it. Don't complain that nobody covered the Women's March. Go out and, you know, stop looking for cable news to care about that. Go start something new.
Yeah.
And I think it's women can be intimidated by that because it's more comfortable to be in a world you know, but then if you look at it as a way to achieve things you hadn't before even imagined were possible, it can be inspiring.
Yeah.
The record number of women that are running for office now, too, and you just see, and the manner in which women are running for office and fully, you know, they're not going over a checklist of things they need to do to prove they're tough enough.
Yeah.
They're running television ads where they're nursing as candidates. You know, they are fully embracing, every aspect of themselves and not feeling inhibited in any way. And that's inspiring. It really feels like a big inflection point. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty revolutionary. You know, when Hillary ran, I didn't go in thinking it was a big deal to elect the first woman president.
Yeah, I read that in here. You said that she was probably more concerned than you were and more aware of what was coming than you and the rest of the team were. How is that?
How is that? looking now, I feel so foolish, but I just, you know, I've been lucky to have a very successful career, and I've had men and women, both mentors who helped me in politics. And, you know, I worked for two presidents, and I felt that Hillary, I thought that women had reached equality, mm-hmm. and there were still some problems, still some kinks, but I didn't think, I thought that, sure, there's going to be a woman president. I guess it's going to be Hillary. Great. Good for her. But my focus in joining the campaign was I just wanted to make sure she got elected because I thought she was the best person for the job. And I didn't see the complexities that were inherent in running a woman.
So gender didn't even really enter your mind as much.
No,
obviously it's there, but...
It's there. It's like the fourth thing, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, I thought it's going to be hard because Democrats are going for a third term. It's going to be hard because the economy is not doing as well as it could, and people have not, particularly on the lower incomes, have not the wages still have continued to grow. And then and there's all the stuff that hangs around Hillary. And fourth, it's the first woman. But I didn't see how that would that or didn't comprehend that it's actually revolutionary still.
Yeah.
Historically speaking, for a woman to be in charge.
The constant complaint about Hillary that you got was this vague feeling of, as you say in the book, there's something I just don't like about Hillary Clinton, or there's something I don't trust about her. Do you think that was code for something else?
I do. And I don't think, and it doesn't, I hesitate to use the word code because that suggests that the person who says it is consciously holding a sexist bias. Yeah. And I really don't think that's what it's about. I don't think that everybody who says, Hillary, I don't know, there's just something about her I just don't like, or I don't think all those people are sexist, or they just, it's just that we have, carry in our heads certain models for how we expect women to behave. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing with Hillary, which it took me a while, it was probably like a year into the campaign that this just became more clear to me, is she's always been someone from the time she was a very young woman who stepped out of the role that women traditionally have held, right?
Right.
So when she was a college student.
Working mom.
And she was a baby boomer. She was on the cover of Life magazine as a senior in college because she challenged the senator who introduced her about the Vietnam War. And she ended up on the cover of Life magazine as like this brash young woman who was the face, the female face of the baby boomer generation.
Oh, that's amazing.
I know. And then the next time you see her, although you don't know it's the same person, she's Bill Clinton's wife who didn't stay home and bake cookies and made more money than him, who wouldn't change her name. And none of that sounds revolutionary in today's world, but it really made people uncomfortable. And it's just, I think that there's something that vexes people. There's something about her that vexes. It confounds us. We don't quite know what to think of her. There's no one you can compare her to.
No one had ever done anything like she had done.
Yeah.
No one, there hadn't been a female presidential candidate before. So, of course, there was some kind of a cognitive disconnect or a discomfort with something that's entirely new.
Yeah.
And that was part of what was at the root of that. Something I don't like about her,
something
I don't trust, because it's just unfamiliar.
It's just unfamiliar, and also I think for a lot of, for men and women both, but also uniquely for women, they felt there was not much about her they could relate to because her experience and her life was so. There's not anyone, literally anyone in the world who has done what she had, and people thought, well, I could never accomplish that. I could never do that. So there's just, she just didn't make sense to people.
Yeah.
And I think maybe this is what the first woman going through this process sort of revealed, for us, where we still have fissures and some gaps to fill.
Yeah. And you say that she was pretty much already aware of all these things, and she was actually reluctant to get into the race. Now, that completely goes against, everyone's impression that she's this ambitious go-getter who has wanted to be president since she was a little kid.
Right.
Why was she reluctant?
I think because she'd been Hillary Clinton her whole life, and so she knows, and she sat me down on my first day in the campaign to sort of spell out just like all the 25 years prior and how her interaction with the press and public and things she tried and, sometimes the press liked her, sometimes they didn't. And, she would, sometimes a particular style would work and then it wouldn't. And all of the, ups and downs of all of the different campaigns she'd been involved in. And she was just, it was really poignant because she just, she said, you know, I'm a simple and serious person, and I just don't understand why I provoke such rage in people. And I laughed when she said she's a simple and serious person because, you know, she's also, you know, brilliant, and she's very warm and funny, and she's an extraordinarily loyal friend. But I get, you know, she's simple in that she's really direct. And the weird thing, the funny thing is, like, as much abuse as she gets about being inauthentic, the truth is she's terrible at faking it. You know, she's like, you know.
Yeah, I remember you saying that in the book. And that rings true to me when I look back at all of the debate coverage. I mean, she couldn't hide her reactions to these insane things coming out of her opponent's mouth.
Press ask her a question that she thinks is stupid. It just you know the look I'm talking about. Yeah. It just shows all over her face. So she was reluctant to get in because she, you know, I think she's the least surprised that she lost of all of us.
Wow.
But she was convinced that she was the person who was probably best positioned to win. That was, you know, her belief. I think that was right. And she had faith in her ability to do the job.
Mm-hmm. And some readers of Dear Madam President might also be surprised to learn that when Hillary Clinton was considering how to frame her campaign and how she wanted to do her announcement, you say she didn't think that her personal story was very compelling. Now, this is in spite of the fact she's the first female candidate for president, battle-tested through myriad of crises and personal attacks, Secretary of State. How could she not think that her story was interesting?
Isn't it funny? But
yeah.
I thought I agreed with her, though. I mean,
really?
And I'm embarrassed to admit it now, but she said, you know, what she said was, my husband has a story. You know,
the man from Hope. Yeah.
Yes. You know, President Obama has a story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a story. And she's like, I grew up middle class. I didn't really have a, you know, I didn't really struggle. Then all this stuff happened to me. That's Bill's story. It's not my story. And, you know, there's all this controversy and that just weighs me down. That's like, no one can relate to this. It's just, I don't have a story that's interesting to people. This is not unusual. Most women candidates, I've come to learn, don't think they have an interesting story. They don't think their life story is interesting.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happens to people who are making history. You know, you don't recognize the value of their story in real time. And the canon of American great, you know, stories usually are written, you know, about men by men. It's not as if, you know, I said in the book, the future is female. The past was, too. It's just no one thought it was important enough to write it all down. So, you know, I had hoped a glass ceiling would shatter on election night 2016. That's not what happened. But something sure did, because it feels like the world has been blown open and women are seeing more possibility now.
In one of the lighter moments of the book, at one point, you talk about how it seemed like she was running not just against Donald Trump, but against Putin and Julian Assange and Comey. You compared the election actually to a Batman movie. Who makes up the cast of characters in your version of Batman, Jennifer?
Well, who plays them? Or it felt like it, you know, like the Christopher Nolan style, the super dark Batman movies where you had two candidates from Gotham, you know, Hillary and Trump.
Right.
You had, I felt like, you had your main villain, who was Trump, and then you had these side villains, as they do, in the form of Assange and Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have people like, you know, how Catwoman is sometimes on your side and sometimes not. So that's Comey. And then President Obama's Commissioner Gordon, and the fate of the world hung in the balance. So. And I joked about that in the summer with Hillary and Senator Kaine. But the closer we got in October, it was scary, it was a scary place. It was, and just surreal. I mean, I had to a number of times, literally many times a day, I would have to pause and, you know, and confirm that I was not dreaming about whatever whacked out latest development had happened. I mean, you had, you know, the semi-hostile state, Russia weighing in to try to influence, you know, and then you had the FBI director who just couldn't seem to, like, you know, mind his own business and understand that the American people got to decide things. And Yeah. Plus everything Trump was doing, and you know, is something.
Yeah, I mean, if it were any other person, I wouldn't have believed any of it. But, you know, the more and more you get to know the man, it all starts to seem entirely plausible. You know, I say that about the dossier. You know, everyone's saying, oh, that couldn't possibly be that he had a pee party in a hotel in Russia with two hookers. Yet, suddenly these things come out. A Playboy playmate and a porn star, and it's been verified. Suddenly that stuff doesn't seem so insane anymore in context.
It doesn't seem so insane. I think you have to... Yeah, and the involvement of Russia appears to be deeper than even I had been suspicious, and Cambridge Analytica and stealing data from Facebook, and it just it all is, you know, people said we were paranoid in real time, but it's playing out to be actually worse than I imagined.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Jennifer Palmieri when we come back in just a minute. If you're a business owner, things like email and software ought to be easy, right? Not something you have to spend your days thinking about. And you sure don't want to worry about hackers and spammers infecting your system, stealing your data, and holding it hostage. That's what makes AppRiver a great choice, especially for companies that don't have an IT department. For small and mid-sized businesses, AppRiver can be your IT team, or at least free up your computer nerds to do things that actually make you money. With AppRiver, you can get email, spam and virus filtering, email encryption, archiving and compliance solutions. They can secure your email on your servers or just handle it for you with Office 365 or hosted Exchange. Their services are all cloud-based, so you pay a subscription instead of buying hardware, software, and licenses. Try any of their services free, cancel anytime, and know that their U.S.-based phenomenal care is available all day, every day. Ready to make IT easy? Visit appriver.com/kickass and try any of their services free. That's appriver.com/kickass. And now, back to the podcast. Well, I want to ask you about Hillary's emails one more time. Just
oh, great.
For the hell
please,
of it here.
By all means, let's do it.
You know, when that came out, I never expected that it would matter. This issue of a private server or emails was going to stick with voters because it just seemed to me it's too complex and technical. I didn't see any nefarious intent on her part. And to me, it just seemed like much ado about nothing. So why, in your estimation, did the email issue hang around her like this rain cloud following Charlie Brown throughout the whole election?
God bless you, but you are unique in your takeaway. I think the emails was the issue that we're in which we saw manifested some unease people still have about women and ambition. And again, like I always want to say, like I don't think that this is conscious. I think, you know, gender bias isn't gender biased. I think that we all hold these things in our head. And I think that because what seemed to me to be at the root of that was suspicion about her motivations.
Okay.
Right. It was always, you know, so, well, you know, why did she do this? Well,
same
it's
as
legal.
The usual conspiracies around her.
Right. Yeah. So it's like, well, why did she use this personal email? Like, well, other cabinet secretaries did. It actually was allowed. It's like, well, why did she do it? Well, it was like more convenient. Well, why did she have a personal server? Well, her husband's former president of the United States. The government had provided him with a personal server. If your spouse had a server, you probably would use it too. But why did she really do it? No, why did she really do it? And you realize this is all about suspicion about her motivation. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it just occurred to me at one point because it was like, well, she needs to admit a mistake. She admits it's a mistake. She needs to apologize. She apologizes. It's just like, and it's never enough. And I just, it's like, this feels like you want her to confess. You know,
To the private server or to the murders?
To the
which one?
To the private server.
To
like it was. It was. You know. It just felt like. It just occurred to me that you're never. No one. People are not going to be satisfied with the answer because they want. It was. You know. It felt. I was like. This feels like the witch trials. That there's motive. And I think that it's. It is. You know. This question of. You know. When this is. It's true for women in power. Is. unease about why they're doing this or why they're seeking it. And, you know, any pollster who works for a woman candidate will tell you that the questions people, voters have about women are different. They're, you know, you really have to explain why you're motivated to be in the race. And we would always have to position everything that Hillary did as being in service to others.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, you know, she constantly felt like she was in the position of having to explain this over and over again. And the answer was never good enough.
Yeah.
Because in the book, you say she actually wanted to keep addressing the issue of the FBI investigation in her speech once it was reopened by James Comey.
Yeah.
But the team convinced her to address it and then move on and stay on message, which is total politics 101.
Right.
You know, if you're playing defense, then you're losing.
Blah, blah, blah.
In retrospect, do you think that she was right? She should have kept pushing back against the investigation?
I do, because this is, you know, as you noted, at the end of the campaign. And, you know, it seemed impossible that the right advice you would give her at the time was, by all means, let's end the campaign talking about emails. That would be amazing. So it seemed that couldn't possibly be the right advice for her. But the truth is, she could tell it was on everybody's minds. People had questions about it, and she felt like she should have, you know, had addressed. And I think that, you know, to me, Donald Trump is the, you know, Donald Trump came to the industry of politics and democracy to prove to all of us that it is broken.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He is like Uber come to taxi drivers.
He,
you know, I really believe this, that so this, you know, there are all these rules in politics about, you know, you don't respond to attacks because that just draws more attention to them. And you have to stay on message and talk about the economy and not about whatever is in the press. And, you know, what I found was she couldn't be heard about the economy because the press was focused on emails or what. And you can't ignore what's being talked about in the public square because people have questions, and then they wonder if you don't respond, you look evasive. And so I think we're in the middle of revolutions in many parts of our society, and politics is certainly one of them. And I hope that, you know, what seems to be rising in the country is a sense of, you know, citizen engagement in profound numbers, new kinds of candidates, and you know, people like Beto O'Rourke running in Texas, you know, very grassroots style campaign, very close to the ground. I think that's what the future is.
Yeah, you described the 2016 election as a reckoning of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, did you or anyone in the campaign see some rumblings of this sea change coming?
Every single day.
Really?
Every single day.
No kidding.
You saw something that told you Donald Trump could win.
Mm.
I mean, from March 20th, 2015, when I first joined the race, to November 8th, 2016, when we lost it. I mean, it was not like anything I had ever seen before. And it did feel to me, and it's very disturbing because it felt like all of these frustrations that had been roiling under the surface because of a number of factors, including, you know, incredible disruption and change, two wars, 9/11, wages not growing, big demographic changes, a digital economy. And the one unifying thread that makes me feel hopeful about our future that I saw even then, and I see even more so now, is that each of these, you know, everyone that you saw who was frustrated, whether it's a Black Lives Matter protester or a dreamer or, you know, an unemployed coal worker that Hillary had met in West Virginia, they all believed that the country should be, that they expected more of America, that it could be doing better than it was, and it wasn't living up to its ideals.
I want to press you on that a little bit because I have a hard time with it. You know, when I hear a lot of people saying things like, these are literal quotes, they want to burn it all down, or we want to tear down the whole system. Heck, even just a few days ago, I have a friend who's bought into the whole deep state conspiracy, and he was saying, seriously suggesting with a straight face that we need to shut down the FBI and the CIA and just have a quote-unquote clean slate.
Right.
That doesn't sound like people who want to make America better. That just sounds like nihilism and anarchy to me.
You know, I start from this place. I start from the belief and like the fundamental goodness of the principles the country is founded on and the people in it. And I'm an optimistic person. I think that there is a 62% chance the country comes out of this period that we're in stronger, and a 38% chance that we dissolve into a pit of fiery racial hatred. Right?
So, okay. I don't know if I like those odds.
Okay, but 62% is pretty good, but it means we have to work at it. So if you believe, and that's why I called the book Dear Madam President, because I want the person reading it to think there is a positive outcome here. Mm-hmm. So if you believe that the country is going to survive this, where do you start? So what I see, what I look for in these different groups of people who are frustrated is what's one core thing? And I think it's like they all believe that America can be better than it is now, that it's not right. So your friend who wants to, you know, he's got a great idea. He wants to get rid of the FBI and start over because that's going to make it. But it's
so make America great again. Well, still, it's like fits within that definition.
I think it means it's like it's not living up to the promise that I thought this country was going to be. Okay. And it's like so you think it should be something that is capable of being more and better than it is. And I think that a mistake of people like me and to some degree in our campaign, although by the time we tried to, you know, we got there and started trying to talk to people, it was too late for them to hear you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, presidential candidates have to listen to everyone. You got to have a solution for everyone. You got to make sure that everyone in America understands that you think they belong here and have a place and that there is some that they can see, recognize, imagine where they fit in the future of the country. And then I think people can stop pitting themselves against each other. But that's, you know, I think that we were just due for this reckoning. Mm.
Well, I have to ask you about Election Day, if you don't mind, if it's not too traumatizing.
I talk about it every day now. Well,
yeah, give us a contrast between your Election Day and the morning after from your point of view. What was that like for you?
I didn't, you know, I woke up with on Election Day itself, I woke up feeling very uneasy. I don't think that it was because I wasn't worried we were going to lose. You know, it's I just at the end of a hard effort, I often feel the stress that I've been holding off will like demand its due at the end. And I had a terrible feeling that day. I also had a terminally ill sister that was expected to die at any moment. So that was a hard day. But as hard as that day actually was, weirdly for me to face, the morning after, and I describe this in pretty stark detail in the book because I think a lot of people experienced it the same way I did, even though they weren't part of the campaign. And I want those people to recognize their story in my book. Like, you're not alone. A lot of people felt this way. And if you didn't, understand how we did feel, which is like I felt I woke up into a different universe. It's like quite literally. It felt like the movie scene that you would never see. It is the scene where you do not save the world just in time, right? Where you don't succeed in defusing the bomb just in time.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The bomb goes off and the world explodes. I felt like I was hurled into a black hole.
Yeah.
I actually even had I really believe this. I looked at my phone and I thought, I bet this doesn't work anymore. I didn't think it would be possible for me to call my colleagues because I thought this can't. That's like how disoriented it felt to me.
Yeah. And I think for a lot of people, I think it's crazy to say this maybe, and maybe it's inappropriate, but I think there are a lot of people who would equate it to how they felt after 9/11.
Yeah.
Believe it or not.
Yeah. I think that you know, it's like you can't compare it to that because that was, you know,
but it was definitely a new reality.
Thousands of Americans losing their lives.
Right. But in terms of overturning their reality.
A new reality. It was it's literally a new world. I had this panic of just so desperately wanting to get back to the old world that I knew and I understood how it operated and felt that way for, you know, a long time. I mean, weeks. And then you realize I saw the Women's March the day after the inauguration. And I thought, I was in New Orleans for the inauguration and I purposely didn't go to one. Because I wanted to hang back and see how America was going to handle this. And I wanted to like take my hands off the wheel.
Yeah.
And
that's kind of what you're doing with this book.
Yeah. And then I saw what happened and I was amazed and I was so relieved that, you know, his election was a big action, but there was a big reaction to it. And that was when I first started thinking about taking these lessons and bringing them into a positive space, because I was so intrigued and relieved that women's reaction wasn't to be crushed, but to start fighting back. And they knew that they deserved and could have more than they did in that moment. And it's been remarkable to see. And it's like, I want this book to be like a handbook, a guide for those women. I had so many of them in my mind, you know, middle-aged women who march, or young women who march, or high school girls who are like, what do you mean that guy won? And what does that mean for me? And, you know, women who came before me. And it's like a love letter to all of them.
Yeah.
That you were right to have those doubts in your mind for your whole life about, well, I'm not really sure that these are the right rules for me. They're not. They weren't made for you. So go make your own.
And another woman that has a profound impact on you was the late Elizabeth Edwards. Mm-hmm. She did something with a whiteboard, a chalkboard, that really changed your own perspective on life. Tell us a little about that.
So this is the wife of John Edwards. We became good friends, and I had worked for him on the 2004 presidential campaign. And she, you know, she had a lot of tragedy in her life. She lost a son at age 16 when he was 16, her son Wade. I've learned it's very important when people lose a child to always say the child's name. So I just, for listeners that don't know that, it's an important life lesson. And then she, you know, had her own very public troubles with her marriage, and eventually got cancer herself. And she told me that after Wade died, she had imagined that her life was like a chalkboard, which everything that she had to do, wanted to do, needed to do, worried about, was scribbled up in tiny letters on this chalkboard, and every inch of it was taken up. And then she lost Wade, and the entire board was wiped clean. And she let it sit empty for a long time, because she's like, when that happens, you want to be really deliberate about what you put back up on that board, because you really want it to matter. And I thought she decided, she was very deliberate about thinking, how am I going to bring joy back into my life? Which I just love that concept, because she was so willful. She thought that she could will joy back into her life. And so she decided to have two children, Emma Claire and Jack, and they brought a lot of joy into her life. But I thought that I understood her chalkboard. I thought that I, you know, at the time I thought it meant you want to make sure your life is rewarding because there's so little you control. And then after I had my own experience with my new universe on Wednesday, November 9th, 2016, I thought, no, the point is there's so little there's so little that's in your control. Anything can happen to you to blow up your life at any moment. You want to make sure that your life matters and what you do matters. You know, so what June Carter Cash used to say, right? I'm just trying to matter.
That's right.
That is, you know, that's why I wanted to write the book. You want it all to be adding up to something to matter.
Well, you open up about your fear of the end of the campaign, when you would have to face the void in your life of not being on a campaign or working in the White House. Has that been a little easier than you thought, looking back?
It's so amazing to me. Yeah, I was really concerned about it. I think that was part of the unease I felt on election day was, wow, I have put my whole heart and soul into this campaign. It's given me, I feel that I have value because of it. And what's my value going to be when it's over? And it just went away.
Okay.
It went away like overnight, just by believing that I had put my very best effort into something that mattered. And even though we lost, I still feel proud of the effort that we put into it. And I know that can frustrate some people to hear it, because they think that we should have won. And so did I. But coming out of that, I felt like I don't need to be in the White House or be on a presidential campaign to feel that what I'm doing is important. I just need to feel that it is something that is going to matter. And so I was grateful to have the chance to write this book, because I was sort of surprised to learn that I like writing, and I like just being in a room by myself and being like, I think this, hit send. No, not 18 people get to look at it and review it and wordsmith it. And that to me feels like that, you know, like that was really rewarding and that matters. So I have been freed from that. Yeah. you know, there's other concerns. It's good.
Well, hopefully this will be the first of many.
I hope so. Yeah. It's, I mean, Amazon sold out the night before it came out. So
that's a good sign.
Yeah, it's good. It was the number two selling nonfiction book.
Amazon, Washington Post, Jeff Bezos.
Yes, yes.
Of course it's sold out.
Of course it's sold out. There's a conspiracy. I don't know.
Well, before we go, real quickly, I just have to ask, there's no love lost between the Hillary campaign and James Comey. Have the events since the election maybe softened your opinion of Comey a little?
I don't hold a lot of hate in my heart, and I don't have so I just think with Comey, I think that he was too interested in, I know he looks at it as he was trying to protect the integrity of the FBI, mm-hmm. and I think he was trying to protect his own reputation, mm-hmm. and he took extraordinary steps that are outside of the realm of how the FBI normally and is supposed to behave because he thought he knew better.
Yeah.
And but I don't think that – I don't believe he was trying to hurt Hillary Clinton. I think that – I don't believe that. I know other people do. Mm-hmm. I don't. But I do think that he had a very damaging impact because he was concerned about how it was going to reflect on him.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, once more, the book is called Dear Madam President, An Open Letter to the Women Who Will Run the World. Jennifer Palmieri, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Really delightful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again to Jennifer Palmieri for coming on the podcast. Order her book, Dear Madam President, An Open Letter to the Women Who Will Run the World, on Amazon, or download the audio version at audible.com. And follow Jennifer on Twitter at JMPalmieri. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.